Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Coming in for a landing now with Mert Weedman of Shafter, California. Still a licensed and practicing pharmacist at age 92. At age 50, he earned his pilot's license and enjoyed decades of flying between the different drugstores he owned. His flying in World War II was as a passenger and under very different conditions. He was taking off in a PB-4Y2 off of a coral runway on the Eniwetok Atoll. He remembers how they had to dump seawater on the runway to sustain the coral and keep it from disintegrating into sand. And he certainly remembers those death-defying flights into vicious typhoons, sitting up front between pilot and co-pilot to try to learn how to predict how these destructive weather patterns would operate. And those planes you were flying in, Mert, were real war planes loaded with bombs and bullets.
It had 6 turrets, right, two on top, one on each side, one in the tail and one in the front. Those guys went in that typhoon in their position as gunners. So the gunner in the tail, he was strapped in there with his machine gun, and the two on top were strapped in there with their, and so they were strapped in there. They weren't sitting in a chair or something inside, which is kind of interesting. So they were all in their fighting positions when they went in there, because you don't have, well, first place, you don't have room in the bomber to, you know, you have the bombs all in the center, and you have the radioman sitting there at his desk, and it was tough on those kids.
Yeah, and so to hammer home your point here, this is a PB-4Y2, which is a B-24 that's been converted to Navy use. They call it a privateer. And so it's fully loaded with bombs and fully staffed with gunners. So if you guys see a Japanese target, they would spring into action.
That's right.
And you're along for the ride, and you sat right up front between the pilots?
Yeah, I sat. They have a jump seat there.
And so as you get into the typhoon,
I'm still in the jump seat.
And you're looking at the instrument panel. And what are the readings that you're getting from that instrument panel?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm supposed to get ready, but lots of times you can read them. I mean, it's raining, it's dark, bouncing up and down, and just your head is just going from one side to the other, and you're scared to death you're going to go down.
Can you see where you're going?
Well, you can, but it's visibility isn't good.
Yeah.
But the pilot, this one pilot we had, 26 years old, Russ Hamilton, and I went with a lot of pilots, but he was the top. He was just so calm and just had a lot of respect for him. In fact, we became very good friends after the war and visited each other.
One thing you said when you introduced this idea of typhoon reconnaissance, you said you were the first Navy weather officer to fly into a typhoon on purpose.
That's right.
The implication is a lot of the guys who flew into typhoons not on purpose didn't live to tell the story.
Probably.
Can you give us a sense of some of those moments where you start to think, you know, I'm going to end up like those guys? I'm not going to get out of this? This plane's not going to make it out of this?
Well, you learn to pray.
I bet. What do you pray?
I pray that we get out of it. Uh-huh. You're just praying for yourself and the crew.
Yeah.
Not thinking about your family or any, well, you're thinking about losing, you know, never seeing them again. But, you know, people don't realize that that's how the Navy got the information, where his planes went out there in those typhoons. And they're doing the same thing today in the Gulf.
Hurricanes.
And of course, you have a lot of different planes, too. But then when you compare it to what I went through, I was in a warm airplane and secured, and I got through it. And it was a rough thing, a scared thing to death about it. But then you think about these kids, that it doesn't even compare how bad it was for those kids. I hate to even talk about it, because I hate to even get any credit for that, because when I think about all the terrible things they had to do in the invasion of Europe and the invasion of these islands, you know, just killed on the beach. And so I didn't even talk about myself.
Well,
you know, I really do. It just doesn't compare with what those young 18-year-old kids went through on those beaches to take those islands. And people ought to know about that and not forget that, what those kids did sacrifice.
Well, amen. And I'll tell you, you're not alone. Just about everybody I've had on this program shares similar sentiments, that they don't think they should be the ones that get the attention. It should be those, especially the ones who didn't come home, 406,000 Americans. But you came close enough to adding to that number, and you put your life at risk, and you knew you were putting your life at risk with a pregnant wife back home. And I think the other thing that we need to try to understand here is, I wonder how many lives you helped save, you with that crew, to fly into those typhoons and to glean whatever you could about their tendencies and their nature and what they were going to do. That probably did save some lives in the future.
Oh, I'm sure it did, because the Navy later on had typhoons, you know, that they had to reckon with, but at least they knew where they were, and there was avoidance problem or taking the lesser side of the typhoon, you know. But anyway, I mean, it did. I know it saved lives. And it's something that people don't even think about. I mean, nobody has ever heard of the typhoon reconnaissance.
Well, they have now, because you're telling your story. And I know there's a lot more to your story. And just with that part of it, of flying into the typhoons, is there anything else that you can share to help us understand what that really feels like when you're entering or exiting that typhoon? I mean, is it like getting put in a blender, getting shaken all around? Or how would you describe it?
You think the plane is going down. It's going sideways. It's going up and down. You know, when you hit those tremendous updrafts, gosh, you know, it's like going into overland and hit a tornado, you know. That's about like, you don't want to fly into a tornado. You don't want to fly into a thunderstorm,
right?
You know. And that's what it was, just like a big thunderstorm. I don't know what to tell you other than just you're frightened and you have no choice, just like the pilot has no choice. He didn't want to go in there. Mm-hmm. They hated it.
When did you find out that you were a father?
1 month after the baby was born. The baby was born on September 15th. We went to the Navy church there and I gave thanks. The baby had arrived all right and it was doing okay. And my father-in-law sent a telegram.
Well, that was good news. And about 2 weeks before that, there was really good news because the Japanese signed the surrender on the USS Missouri. I understand your pilot was flying that day and put a scare into some Japanese. Were you on that plane or no?
Yeah, at Pohnpei we went. There's a ridge of trees that extend out from the harbor. He came in real low. Now, the armistice was being signed that day, and he came in very low, right over the deck, and he lifted up the plane up over those trees and dropped down into that harbor there. And the Japanese just jumped off the boats, you know, everybody, all they were diving in the water. And of course, retrospect, I thought, that was really dumb. What if they took a shot at him? But they wouldn't care. I mean, nobody would know it if they shot down a plane, except they would know it.
Yeah.
And just do it for the kicks, just like we're doing it for the kicks. So it was a dumb thing to do. Very dumb thing to do.
I understand another thing you guys had a chance to do with that plane, which after all is a bomber, was you guys dropped something, but it wasn't bombs. You dropped some goodies for the kids down there?
You know, it's just amazing how those guys out of their own pockets, as a number of atolls, like Bikini Atoll, where they had the bomb later on, there were just natives living there, no Japanese. And then below Pohnpei, there was another island, not a very big island. I know we used to go around it, had a church on it, and it wasn't even part of the picture. They just took the plane out of way to go down there. Some way they'd been there before. And so this one crew always loaded up the plane. They had clothing, they had candy bars, they just a bunch of stuff. And so the pilot would fly right down on the deck. I mean, he'd be below the treetops with that four-engine bomber, right over the water, right over the beach. Everybody come running out. They knew what to expect. They all come out there on the beach, all those people. And then they'd drop down. The kids would kick off these packages to them, you know, and take another round. And they'd all scrambling to open them up, candy bars and what have you. And they all paid for it, you know. It wasn't anything the Navy furnished or anything. Uh-huh. May furnish the clothing or furnish some things.
That must have felt pretty good to be a part of that.
Oh, it was fun to watch them.
Kind of like being Santa Claus?
Yeah, I would love to have gone down there and visited that island or some of the other atolls. We flew over atolls nobody was on. You know, water surrounded by islands. And you just think how much fun it would be to take a boat there into that atoll and onto those little islands. They all had a few coconut trees. One atoll we went by, it was south of Eniwetok, had a zero. It looked like that zero was absolutely perfect shape, and not a person lived on the island. It was just somehow, maybe he's off a Japanese carrier or something, you know, and ran out of gas and landed on it.
Maybe it was Amelia Earhart.
Let me tell you about Amelia Earhart now that we're bringing that up. Our office was with the intelligence. I mean, we had an office right there, and I just opened up the file drawers to look and see it. And they had lots of photographs taken by the Navy in 1935 of all those Japanese held islands. And the Navy said they were going down looking for Amelia Earhart. But what it was, I think some smart guy said, hey, wait a minute, let's see what the Japanese are doing down there. Because they took over all those islands, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of pictures of those islands showing in 1935 what the fortifications they had at that time. But at least it showed, gave them an idea of what that island looked like.
So the search for Amelia Earhart had a dual purpose.
I'm positive of that.
Was it a big deal to you guys? I know your job had to do with the weather, and you weren't firing at anyone yourself. But when you found out that Japan had surrendered and that this thing is all over, was that a significant day for you?
Oh, man, was it. Everybody knew it was just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look at all the men it saved. Then there were two bombs they dropped. Some do-gooders, you know, say that was a terrible thing to do. But you either lost whatever you would have lost, hundreds of thousands of men going into Japan. Look what they did with the kamikaze pilots, what they did to our fleet.
Just the conservative estimates said an invasion would have cost a million American lives and way more Japanese lives than that. And you eventually got to come home and see your wife again and see that baby you hadn't met yet.
Right.
What was that homecoming like for you?
Well, I cried. I cried when I left and I cried when I came home.
Mm-hmm. And how old was your daughter?
She was 6 months old.
You were one of four brothers who served, and you all four came home. You did go to pharmacy school. You once played football for UCLA, but you ended up with a USC degree. I mean, did UCLA ever forgive you for that?
No.
You come back to your hometown of Shafter. You take over the pharmacy with your wife from her father, and you are still a pharmacist today. You're 92, but you keep up your license, and you make a two-hour drive up to Fresno to your daughter Lynn's pharmacy, and you sit behind that counter and you check prescriptions. Why do you keep doing this? Why is that important to you to continue to stay involved in that way?
Well, two things. I enjoy it very much, and then Lynn really enjoys it when I go up there because that leaves her free so she can take care of other things, and she does a lot of things for Nola and I anyway, and so it's my way of getting even with her, helping her out.
So how long are you going to keep doing that, going into the pharmacy and helping them out?
Well, as long as I can do it, because I enjoy it, first of all, and then it's helping Lynn, and as long as she wants to do it, and as long as I can, I'm going to help her.
Well, I know you need to focus on your work when you're there, but maybe one of these days someone will walk into Bullard Pharmacy and say, hey, is that Typhoon Reconnaissance guy behind the counter over there?
I had the best job that anybody could have, being a pharmacist of the only drugstore in town, born and raised in the town, graduated from all the schools here in Shafter. Knowing so many people here, so I had the best job in the world.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in such a unique way. Thank you for telling us your story so we understand a little more now. Is there anything else that you want to say about those guys that you served with and how they should be remembered all these years later?
They all should be remembered. And I think that's a problem today. People have forgotten all about. And thanks to you, Paul, you're the one keeping it alive. If it weren't for you, there'd be no knowledge or of anything that went on, and people would forget about it, all this new generation. And thanks to you, and I'm really proud to meet you and talk to you and given a chance to tell my side of the story. And I think that what you're doing is a tremendous thing. It is just absolutely wonderful. Wow. People don't know. My own grandkids don't know. I've never sat down and talked with them like I've been talked to you, you know. And I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing.
It's a privilege to share your story with your grandkids and other people listening. And since we're on that topic, as you look back over 92 years, almost all of them here in Shafter, everything that you did in the military, in business, seeing your children carrying on those kind of businesses and still participating that way, when you look back over all of it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I don't know how to say that, how to answer that, but because I've been proud of all my family, very proud of my new wife. She was my wife's cousin. Her husband died and my wife died, and we got together. I'm very proud of my former wife that's passed on. I'm proud that she's a good, fine Christian lady, and our whole family are Christians. I think there's lots of things that I could have done better, but it's a unique opportunity to do what I had in. A poor farm boy enters into a going drugstore without putting any money into it except time and effort. I was very fortunate. Extremely fortunate.
Well, I know your hometown of Shafter feels fortunate to have had you here for 92 years, and it's a good thing you survived flying into those typhoons on purpose. That's Mert Weedman. You'll find photos of him then and now, and some short videos too, at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.